www.thebrainfarm.com.
This is Chris Evans recording a Storage Unpacked podcast, and this is the second part of our end of year podcast, although it is actually technically the 11th of January when we're recording this. So we're not actually end of year, but we are going to talk about the end of 2021 and into 2022. So we did a podcast a few weeks ago, and we had three of us on. We had two Chris's and a Martin. We've now got two Chris's, a Martin, and an Eric. We've increased by an Eric. We've raised ourselves an Eric. So I'm really, really pleased to say that we've got Eric Herzog joining us, who's now with Infinidat. How are you doing, Eric?
Hi, Chris. Thank you very much. Welcome. Really appreciate being part of the team.
Well, you know, it'll be a fun discussion. I think it'll be good. So tell you what, just in case anybody, do you think anybody doesn't know who Eric is, everybody? You know, I think, Chris, go on, you told everybody who Eric was, so everybody does know who Eric is. But Eric, seriously, in case anybody doesn't really know who you are or your background, give us the 30-second lift elevator pitch or whatever they call it in America, lift pitch.
Sure. So my name is Eric Herzog, and I'm the CMO of Infinidat, which is a very small but incredibly innovative enterprise storage company. I've done nothing but storage ever since I got a college, or I guess you'd call it university in the UK. I've been with seven startups, well, now eight, because Infinidat theoretically is a small company, but still is not public. So eight startups and five Fortune 500 storage companies, including CMO of the IBM storage division twice, actually, at different times, and also a senior VP at EMC. So done nothing but storage my whole career. I live, eat, and breathe it. And you know, storage is the most important thing in an IT data center or cloud. That's my motto.
Well, can't disagree with that. And your moving on is IBM's loss, but it's Scott's gain, I guess, because he got that job, didn't he, eventually?
Yes, he did.
Yeah, it's good for him. Okay, so I'm going to go back to where we were earlier, and I'm going to look at our list. We talked about all sorts of things, didn't we, guys? We went off, I think, to be honest, I was thinking about it. We talked mostly cloud, actually, funny enough. Chris dragged us into this arena of talking about different cloud vendors and different solutions and hardware and various other things. So I'm going to drag us back a little bit towards the storage arena for the second half of this discussion and start just by pointing out a few things that we had that happened at the end of last year. And the first one being the number of goodbyes we said to different companies. So we lost Datera. We saw DriveScale going into Twitter, which I thought was really interesting. We can talk about that in a second. I think SolidFire slowly, the embers have died on that one. Finally, VMware was kicked out of Dell.
Or escaped, depending on how escaped. You want.
Actually, I think that's a fair measurement, Martin, actually, in some respects. And a lot of vendors went software only. We also saw Micron decide that it didn't like the look of 3D Crosspoint and go off and decide to do its own stuff. So what do we think? Business as usual in the industry to see this sort of thing, Eric, do you think?
Well, you know, storage is a cutthroat business. I view it as, you know, in James Bond, when they capture him, he's got the laser beam in the belt. He's got, you know, the knife in the shoe. You know, his pen is a hand grenade, and they never know. And I would argue that storage is fiercely competitive. One of the things that keeps it going compared to some of the other IT sectors is every time you say, oh, no one wants to buy storage, next thing you read is a ton of fundings. Like I said, I've done eight different small companies and startups. And in every sector, the economy's down. No one's going to invest in startups. Next thing you know, they get invested. So for some reason, the venture capital community constantly keeps coming back to storage. So that means lots of innovation, but it also means that people die out as well because it's so fiercely competitive. So I think that competitive nature of it, but then the constant funding is actually something almost like, if you will, survival of the fittest, you know, when you look at it from a biological perspective. And I think in storage, that really matters most of the time.
Yeah. So actually, Chris, we talked about this very briefly last time. There was a lot more money going into analytics and data companies than there was hardware or traditional vendors.
Yes, it certainly seemed like that last year to my count. I thought that this funding was moving up the stack away from hardware into data analytics and data management. And it seems to be driven by the absolutely catastrophic rise in unstructured data. And I don't know if you're seeing that, Martin, from the Sky point of view.
Well, unstructured data is our business, really. But this is where it's been. But it's nothing new. I mean, we've all been around for a long time. We've all seen the various growth figures. Everybody knew it was going to be unstructured data, which was going to grow. And that's what's happened.
I'm seeing some vendors telling me that it's almost as if a tipping point has been reached or will be reached this year. And Hammerspace, for instance, which has been plowing along for a couple of years now, suddenly is picking up a load of sales and marketing people and think it's got the answer to the enormous increase in unstructured data with its ability to locate files and make them available all across an enterprise. I don't know if this is true, but Hammerspace is certainly going for it. And I think we'll see a lot more of Hammerspace in 2022 than we did last year.
Mm. Let me give you a bit of a background on some of that. So you won't be aware of this, Eric, but I know some of the people in Infinidat from a little bit of work I did a few years ago. And one of the things we talked about at the time was Moshe was very unhappy about the fact that the cloud business was grabbing a lot more, not Infinidat's cloud business, but the cloud was grabbing a lot more attention. And he was looking at ways to be able to adapt Infinidat's technology and try and counter the cloud growth. And obviously things like the sovereign solution, putting it into a co-located data center was one, and stuff like that. I do think that we've reached that point where people are starting to think, well, actually, maybe multi-cloud hybrid is going to work. And now they're starting to think, we want it to work, but we can't get the data moved around very easily. So we're going to see that come more and more. And vendors that are in the hardware space are going to have to find solutions for that too.
So, yeah, I would agree that it's a hybrid cloud world. You know, the early days of the cloud was everyone was going to jump to the cloud. And I think everyone has realized that certain workloads are great in the cloud and certain workloads are not, right? High performance, highly transactional workloads don't fare well. And certain data sets where you're constantly moving back and forth, obviously you are paying for the ingress and egress fees, and those start to add up from a networking perspective. I met with a major university last year, and their president of the university said to the CIO, you know, why are we not all cloud? So he said, can I borrow someone from finance? And they looked at all their workloads, file, block, object, highly transactional, slow, backup, archive, and evaluated everything. And he said borrowing this person from finance, they checked all the four major cloud vendors. So Google, IBM, Microsoft, and Amazon. And he came back that for highly transactional workloads, it was 50% less expensive to stay on-prem, counting the OPEX, all the OPEX, including manpower. And then for certain workloads that were not highly transactional and modified a lot, backup, archive, and some of the other workloads, cloud was ideal. So they adopted a very hybrid strategy based on that and didn't go 100% cloud. So I'd argue for, especially in the global Fortune 2000, there are plenty of workloads that can go to the cloud, and there's other workloads that need to stay on-prem. So I think hybridness is there. The other thing I think is they've gotten to the point where they realize, I don't need one cloud vendor. I might need multiple cloud vendors, whether that be regulatory. As you know, certain countries, the data has to be in that country, and none of the cloud providers have data centers in every country in the world. The other are purely pricing, right? If you're going to get your home painted, you usually get a bid from two or three painters, right? And then you go with the right one based on, you know, references or recommendations and also pricing. So I do think that people are realizing you don't just have only Amazon cloud or only Google cloud or only, you know, Microsoft. It's better to have, you know, have them play against each other, just the way they've always done in the server and the storage world. I think that cloud mentality is maturing. So truly multi-cloud, where you might have two or three cloud vendors, either based on geography, on legal issues, or truly trying to balance your cost structure, which is what they've done with storage and server vendors for years. So I think they're learning we should do that with the cloud guys as well, which gets to that multi-cloud strategy that, you know, Chris M was saying, it's really here. And I think that's why it's really here, with all those things combining.
So I just want to mention to everybody else, Martin and I recorded something yesterday, which will come out in a couple of weeks' time. Might be ahead of this, might be behind this. I'm not really sure yet. I haven't decided on the publication schedule. But that's a big discussion about FinOps, Martin, isn't it? I mean, that was a really interesting conversation. It really sort of plays into what we're just talking about.
Yeah, and one of the things that we were talking about, certainly in the FinOps at the moment, is it's very much focused on almost taking what you're doing today in your data center, and what does that look like in cloud? So it's very much focused on EC2 instances or compute instances, storage. We're, at the moment, a lot of FinOps isn't around cloud native. So there's stuff which is, say, consuming the Lambdas of the world, or those short transient container workloads, or databases as a service. We haven't got a handle on that yet. And big corporates, it's going to take a long time to refactor your code to take advantage of some of that. Some of it will come. We know it will come, but it's going to be a 5-10 year journey for some of this. And by the time you've got there, you probably thought something else. You probably pull it all back again, or be something else which comes along. But we know nothing ever stands still in IT and technology. So that's where we are. But it'll be very interesting to see how that FinOps discipline itself develops.
Absolutely. So moving on to talk about some of the surprises, Chris, I picked out a few, and we should ask Eric to not say a word here, because one of these might be his company. It seems to me that some companies are still doing pretty well. You know, I've made a list here, and some of the most obvious ones are Infinidat and Exagrid. I don't know what Nasuni's doing. You might have seen something on that. But also, we've seen a lot of noise from Weka. We've seen a lot of noise from Vast. So there are definitely companies that are making hay while the sun shines in the storage industry still.
Yes, I think that IBM storage hardware sales are going constantly downwards. It doesn't seem to be anything to stop that at the moment. And I also think that Dell EMC, it's not doing too well in its high-end and its mid-range array space. And I think that's provided a lot of room for new entrants to come in. Infinidat, Weka, Vast Data, and so on. I dare say Dell EMC's power scale is still yet to pick itself up. Doesn't seem to be doing either. He doesn't seem to be doing exceptionally well either. And that provides a good space for Weka to move into, and also for Vast, because they're both file companies. Infinidat, I think, is doing well. Sorry, Eric, spare your blushes, but it is doing well. It's a consistently good news story. It brought out an old solid state array and said it really doesn't matter what the storage, the bulk capacity storage hardware is, because we use memory caching. We got very clever software, and the SSD array will just make it go that little bit faster where we need to, but disk is fine for the majority of people.
Remember, you can't blame Eric for all of this, because he's only just joined, Chris, so we can't have all the glory here.
Spinning around, he's going to be making it spinning even faster, I'm sure.
But I think it's a bit of an indication, Eric, isn't it, you know, that the world is changing, and that it isn't all about big iron, but big iron still has a, or at least when I say big iron, I mean, you know, traditional arrays still have a place.
Yeah, I think the big thing is it's really about application workload and use case, right? Certain workloads probably will stay on-prem, whether it's security issues or performance issues. Other workloads truly will be hybrid, and other workloads, I would argue, backup and archive are pretty good workloads for the cloud. So I think it's all gonna pan out and be, again, this hybrid multi-cloud work that Chris M mentioned earlier before. And I think that that's going to be kind of the steady state for the next 5 to 10 years. Then we'll see if anything radically changes. But yes, I do think that that is a big deal. And I think the one thing with big iron, and I think we proved it with what we've done, is sometimes big iron can be used to consolidate lots of little iron. So, you know, we have a customer, they were using someone else's products. They had 50 arrays, 50 physical arrays. And now they're running all those data sets onto Infinidat InfiniBoxes. So when you do that, it comes down to not only can you deliver the workload right, so as you mentioned with the software, Chris, and the DRAM cache that we do, but at the same time, it also gets to watts, slots, power, floor, operational manpower. And as you know well from talking to the analyst community, you know, there's a cost to manage an array. And if you're managing two arrays versus 50, independent of the CapEx to buy it, is just running it day to day and the manpower and all the stupid things. The failed cable, the failed power supply, the failed flash module, or failed flat hard drive, someone's eventually got to replace that stuff. So if you have one array, big iron, as Chris just mentioned, Mr. Evans, you got the big iron, but it's big iron, but you take out 50 medium to small irons. That big iron is one floor space, if you will, versus four or five with the smaller ones running the same workload. So that's why I think when you think of big iron, you think more monolithic, but when you think of big iron as a consolidation play, for both CapEx and OpEx, while still maintaining the performance, then big iron isn't really big iron, because you're not running one workload on the big iron like the old days. You're running 20 or 30, 40 different applications on the same piece of big iron. You basically carve it up, if you will. So it's not really big iron anymore. It's big iron, I guess it's kind of like the ultimate Swiss Army knife, with each element of the Swiss Army knife being a different application or workload, which is not the traditional way I think of big iron. Since I've been doing this for 38 years now, I think of, you know, one app on a big box, not, you know, 30 or 40 apps running on the same big box, which today you can do that now, certainly with us and with some of our competitors as well. You know, you don't have to run an array for each workload anymore. That's super old school.
Do you think that the the large consolidated array providing a vast array of storage services to a vast array of applications is something that can be managed by a traditional storage admin team? Or will artificial intelligence have to come in much more deeply to run the thing?
So I think it's a mixed bag. One of the things, we have a couple public references on it. They've very specifically said, we've installed the Infinibox and it sat there for 4 or 5 years and we almost never have to touch it. So if you can automatically and autonomously adapt to the workload, which we can do with our software, that makes it easier. At the same time, there is some aspect about managing the array too. You do periodically maybe have to do some sort of migration from a box to another box. You certainly have to make sure you plan for disaster recovery and cyber resilience, right? I am from Silicon Valley, as you guys know, and we really do have earthquakes. And any data center here in a bad earthquake, even a Cat 5, it's toast. So you better make sure you've got that replication stuff. So I think from a workload and use case, the more you can have the automation and the autonomous automatic decision-making by the array is good. I do think for some of the other aspects like disaster recovery and business continuity and cyber resilience, you can automate a lot of it, but you still have to have that human play. One of the things I've noticed is a lot of people don't practice. Martin probably knows a lot of these big accounts, there's some problem, whether it be a cyber attack or a fire in the data center, and they're totally unprepared. They're like chickens with their heads cut off running around. They should have been practicing all that stuff. So that aspect, Chris, still requires that human element to practice the DR, make sure you're vigilant on ransomware. And then if you really have a ransomware attack, you need to practice how you do the recovery, just like if you had an earthquake or a flood. But I do think the application side can be much more easily controlled with, you know, autonomous and automated decision-making by the array adapting to the changes in the workloads. That I think you can absolutely do. But this other aspect of it, the cyber resilience and the disaster recovery, you better still work on that. Otherwise, you're going to leave yourself vulnerable.
We're in a lot better position than we used to be, Martin, aren't we? If you look back even just 10 years, you know, we've come a long way, really.
And from a storage admin point of view, the storage admin role has changed a lot. If you're trying to manage, as Chris was trying to say, if you're trying to manage workloads on an individual basis, these arrays are too big now. If you think you can hand optimize an array better than the machine itself can do with the varying workload patterns, you're probably kidding yourself, or you're not getting the best out of your hardware. You shouldn't be in there. You see it too often, and I still do see storage admins with spreadsheets trying to lay things out, trying to work out what their hot volumes are. Eric's laughing, and he knows it still happens, but we're trying to move away from that. I mean, look at when Eric was IBM and XIV. That was one of the beauties of that. You shouldn't be laying these things out. You should let the machine make a better job of doing this or do this. But then you're right, Chris. And then we've got things like disaster recovery, ransomware. And the role will become simpler at one level, but more complex on another. You've got to be much more business focused. You think about what the business requirements are, what the RTO, RPOs of a business, and they actually be able to start talking about value as opposed to all that spindles running a bit hot.
Yeah, I'll tell you what I think we've ended up in, and we definitely need to focus on it this way. And this is something, actually, I'm going to have my little dig at Dell here. This is something I talked about with them a couple of years ago, before we were told we couldn't travel anymore and we had an actual in-person event. And that's the whole way that you do the automation. So I always look at it and think that we need to start splitting the responsibilities now, so that the person who puts the equipment in, puts it in, provisions it, makes it enabled for use, and then somebody consumes that at the business end from an API. So either the application provisions the storage for you, or the part of the way that you use virtualization or whatever it happens to be, you consume the resources through API. But the guys at the back end, the storage admin, should be moving further and further away from that day-to-day stuff, because it just isn't relevant to their day-to-day job. And you, if you're in the way of that process, then you're slowing people down and you're getting massively in the way of actual productivity. So what you need to do is you need to make the service available and then step away. And then if you have to do maintenance in the background or refreshes or replacement or whatever it happens to be, yes, you do that. If you have to get in there when a disaster occurs, you deal with that. But you need to move away from the day-to-day stuff. It just isn't relevant anymore.
Do you think Nebulon's idea of having a specialized kind of SmartNIC DPU plugged into servers and plugged into storage arrays and doing all the management from the cloud is a helpful way to go here?
Well, I'll tell you my opinion. I think the concept is pretty good, but I struggle with some of the implementations. So when you look at the SmartNIC market and you look at, say, Nebulon are in a position where they basically connect through SAS connectors, they connect the drives that are in that server to the card. So effectively, their card is acting like a SAS controller. And then it presents those drives up to the host as an NVMe device. So you then see those devices and you can boot from them or you can configure them. And then the card replicates the data to others so that you've got some sort of degree of resiliency across servers. So you're in a sort of semi-HCI model. Now, the advantage they've got in that situation and the advantage of things like Nitro and those other technologies is that it becomes host independent. So you can now put an OS on, and as long as that OS, whether it's a hypervisor or a traditional operating system, it doesn't need drivers specifically because what it sees is NVMe drives. So it just sees drives and can consume those. So you can make your technology totally vanilla. You don't have to do the traditional HCI model where you put in a very specific hypervisor and then you replicate the storage, which is running in storage virtual machines between the different members of the cluster. And for example, Nutanix had a real issue with that because they can't replicate a mixed cluster of, say, VMware and their own hypervisor. You have to have one of each. So there are some significant benefits to the idea of offloading the storage, but I think it's the way it's done that's the key piece there, Chris. And other vendors have come up with different ways to do it where that storage is sitting totally separate from that server and it's not an HCI model. And I think they're more likely in the short term to be more successful.
Okay. So smart NICs and DPUs jumping ahead to your agenda item. Do you think they're going to happen this year or is this a 2023 thing?
Well, so I think they're already here. So, you know, we already know that Nebulon have a product. We know that Fungible have a product. And, you know, they've got a sort of split thing. Liquid have got some the stuff that they've been demonstrating for years. They had that at Flash Memory Summit a few years ago where they were demonstrating their Honey Badger, I think is the name of the...
PCIe 4 SSD.
Yep, the PCIe 4 drive. So I think a lot of it's there. And the VMware are coming along with Monterey, you know, as a plugin, which will allow you to abstract resources in and offload some of the networking and some of the storage functionality. I just wonder who it's going to be targeted at, because a lot of this stuff seems to be very much focused at, or probably more appropriate for the hyperscalers or very large enterprises who've got a very distributed environment. So there might not be so many people who will find this technology useful in the short term.
Okay, hyperscalers and people with vast amounts of data and people with large storage arrays. Would this incline Infinidat to support DPUs, Eric?
Well, we are constantly making sure we look at all the technologies. As you know, part of our real magic fairy dust is this incredible software-defined storage technology and be able to use the software on anything. Whatever, whether that be a DPU, whether that be SmartNICs, whether that be the thing that replaces Flash. So when after Flash becomes Hinkelmeyer and after Hinkelmeyer becomes Bleep Snort, and that's, you know, the new types of the media style, because we're software, we can adapt to those changes. So for example, if storage class memory was really cost effective and for some reason you could somehow adapt it into an NVMe array, we could use that because we're media independent. So part of the value of software defined storage is trying to be media and hardware independent. And then if a new hardware comes out, whatever that may be, so like SmartNICs, you would try to take advantage of that and leverage that. That's the value of having a software-centric view of storage versus a hardware view. And obviously, we create storage systems out of that, and doesn't mean we don't do hardware, because we certainly do, but we lead with software first, and that gives companies who do the same thing we do or try to an advantage in adapting to any new hardware design that comes out, whether that be media or whether that be CPU complex related, or because your real focus is the software and then finding out what does the hardware do and then take advantage of that hardware.
Could we see Infinidat supporting BlueField and maybe GPU Direct?
We're looking at everything. Can't divulge any roadmaps, of course.
Done, Chris. Good try.
We've got our CTO and our engineering guys constantly looking at everything that we think can give us a leg up and a competitive advantage. And obviously, over time, things that are early on eventually become commonplace, right? Remember, you know, we've all been around enough to remember when Flash was a niche for the storage world, right?
When ESCOM, right, was a niche.
Yeah, I was going to say. And you know, what's Fiber Channel, which now is, you know, coming towards the end of its life cycle, you could argue. But, you know, I was around when, what's Fiber Channel? Why would I, you know, being talking to big enterprise accounts, what would I want that? You know, not walking through Fiber Channel or Fiber Channel versus SSA, if you want to get really old, before Fiber Channel won that battle. So you know, these things adapt and ebb and flow. And the main thing is when you're software focused, which is what we try to be at Infinidat, you can take advantage of the hardware, leverage the hardware, modify. And by the way, you could use old and new hard. As you pointed out, Chris, we have extensive DRAM cache. Well, guess what? Servers have had DRAM cache for years. Not that the type of RAM hasn't changed, right? But it's still been DRAM cache. We leverage that. We leverage hard drives, which many would argue is very old, invented here in Silicon Valley by IBM in the early 50s. And yet we use flash, which is the newer thing. And again, if storage class RAM was cost effective, we would use that too. It's not right now, so we wouldn't want to use it. But if it ever became cost effective, then we could use that as well. So that's the value of the software side of the world, still using hardware, but optimizing the hardware at a system level, which, you know, if you're hardware only centric, it's how do I put it into silicon basically down the road? And, you know, that's a different play, much more expensive, a lot more. And by the way, you lose the flexibility that the software model tends to give you.
So we can definitely say that Eric is a chief marketing officer, because every opportunity to talk about this, we seem to be going back to Infinidat's products and services, which, you know, is fine, but, you know, I suppose that's his job. Martin, you know, what do you think about the smart NIC world?
It's not really impinged on my world, particularly at the moment. I'm starting to look at it, thinking about it. But at the moment, it's one of those things which people are tinkering with. We're looking at thinking, how are we going to use it? Will we use it? What competitive advantage does it bring to our business? What does it allow us to do better? And at the moment, we're not seeing it. Does it allow us to consolidate further? Does it allow the on-premises environments to have a competitive edge over for some of the cloud environments? We're not quite sure at the moment. It will take time, I think. And we'll need to see how much we're going to need the support. We're not seeing the level of vendor adoption, which I suspect is going to be really important for us to actually make the use of them.
Do you use GPUs much in your environment, Martin?
No, Chris, we don't do GPUs. No, of course we do. We're a video company.
Well, then GPU Direct and Bluefield and things like that, wouldn't they be interesting?
Not for a lot of the stuff we do.
Well, that's a surprise. Is that it's early days yet and we'll move there in the end?
Some of it's early days, but remember, we're not a VFX shop. So a lot of these things actually have are much more interesting for VFX shops. We're not doing a lot of rendering, for instance. When you start getting into rendering and you're throwing data around, then these things become much more interesting. So my friends and colleagues in Soho, for instance, which is where the VFX industry of the UK really hangs out, they're going to be much more interested in some of this stuff. They like this niche stuff. They're much closer related to HPC than, say, a traditional broadcaster.
Okay, so I want to just touch on one other thing on the list before we jump, because we jump forward to predictions a little bit there, Chris. We'll come back to that. And I just want to talk about Amazon and drag us back to the cloud side of storage. It was very interesting to see that FSx brought out a number of other solutions this year. Funny enough, I did some research today and worked out that the OpenZFS, or ZFS, depending on where you are, is actually available on the ARM platform, funny enough. It's not just Intel, which is quite interesting.
It's actually a Graviton only project, I believe.
Is it Graviton only?
Yeah,
it's Graviton. I didn't get to see it was Intel.
And I also think
you could get Lustre on there as well, can't you?
Lustre is moving, so the next generation of their Lustre file system will be on Graviton as well. So they're moving away from the Intel platform for some of these things. I did have a conversation with Amazon trying to get them to explain some of the FSx strategy. But it's no secret that the FSx for Windows is not particularly brilliant.
It's Windows. So yeah. What did we expect it to be?
Well, it's not fully featured. And so they're looking at some of the niche. And all of these, they claim, are driven by customer demand. So OpenZFS will give you a better NFS, or in theory will give you better NFS and some better performance in some places. Lustre, very high performance. I think the really interesting thing about is FSx ONTAP, or whatever, but however branding, I think that's a bit more interesting. And actually, I think it's an acknowledgement by Amazon. But they do have customers who are running instances and they want to be able to share data between their Windows and their Linux environments. The FSx, as it is at the moment, isn't particularly brilliant for it. And the NetApp allows them to do SMB, allows them to do NFS and actually have the same share. And it allows that certain degree of comfort as well. Big enterprises have got quite comfortable with ONTAP. The fact is they can use the same thing.
Yeah, it's a clever move, really. I mean, you've got to admire the tenacity of NetApp to the way they've got to with the development of ONTAP in the cloud. You know, what looked like 5 years ago, 6 years ago, what looked like an interesting idea then sort of ended up in a bit of a mismatch of different technologies that have all sort of plugged together, has slowly evolved into something which is really quite slick in the fact that it's natively supported in the clouds. And here's a question for you, Eric. Does that represent a challenge for other vendors who might want to do something similar? I mean, can you imagine Infinidat having a software-only version in the cloud, for example, or any other vendor, you know, IBM, you name it?
So that has been the trend in the industry since I came from IBM. Their Spectrum Virtualized and their Spectrum Scale products can sit in a virtual machine, or in the case of Scale, in a container environment with any cloud provider. So, you know, part of the way a system vendor would incorporate is, if you will, every storage system has, if you will, a storage OS. And the main thing is taking that storage OS, as Chris Miller called it, the software technology, and just having it sit in a different location. So that's the kind of thing, again, we talked about taking advantage from a software perspective, the type of things that we would look at to do, because then you can spread around. It also gets back to the original theme that you brought up, Chris, about hybridness. That multi-cloud hybridness is where the world is going. So that would lend to, you know, you need to have stuff on-prem, but you need to have stuff off-prem. How do you make that seamless? You can't just go to an object store all the time, right? Yep. For certain workloads, yes, but for other workloads, having that flexibility and being able to have an instantiation of your, if you will, your storage operating system sitting at the cloud vendor, whether it be in a container or in a virtual machine, gives that seamless integration between on-prem and off-prem that companies are looking to do in this world of hybrid multi-cloud.
Pure Storage looks to be following in NetApp's footsteps, at least in the Amazon area, with its cloud block store, and also with Portworx picking up on the container side of things.
Yeah, they've got an Azure version as well. And you can get Pure Storage products in Equinix, so you can do the co-location thing too. So I think they're making an effort to try and get in there. Now, I'd be interested to know, Martin and I talked about this the other week. We weren't sure whether the NetApp platform supports block devices or just file. And it'd be interesting to know whether the Cloud Block Store eventually would support file protocols, because the current on-premises solution can, you know, with the CompuVerde acquisition, wasn't it, that added that in. Yep. So they can do that. So it makes you wonder whether we might see a renaissance in file systems, the way that Amazon are doing it, but just generally because it's a more portable format than block devices. I personally think it would be a better solution long-term for the cloud.
I think the major on-premises storage vendors are going to have to support file, block, and object in the public clouds eventually. I think they'll be forced to do that because their customers will want symmetrical environments.
Well, Chris, some of the vendors are doing that. So certain vendors have their product, you know, the place I used to work most recently until a couple months ago has, you know, seamless integration with file, and seamless integration with block, and seamless integration with object on multiple clouds. So you can go on-prem to off-prem, and other people that we just talked about were doing it with NetApp on the file side, and what Portworx is doing for Pure in the container side. So I think that's kind of, again, getting back to your original comment about hybrid multi-cloud, that if you're going to be hybrid multi-cloud, it's the power of that software that allows that data to move back and forth seamlessly. And obviously in the backup space, all the backup, major backup vendors are already doing that. You can back up on-prem, back up to the cloud. You can have certain backup data sets go out to the cloud, certain go on-prem only, certain do on-prem, and then, if you will, vault it out to the cloud in case there is an earthquake or a fire in the data center, right? You don't want all your backup remote because, you know, if you have an issue, you need to back up or restore a couple servers. If it's all coming off a cloud vendor, that may not be the best solution to be up and running quickly. So you've got backup both on-prem and off-prem. So the backup software guys have been doing this now for a while in envisioning that world that Chris Miller mentioned, which is the hybrid multi-cloud world. And I think the storage system guys are just kind of following suit. NetApp did it earlier, but I think everyone's doing it. IBM clearly is doing it with a couple of their products. So I think that everyone is sort of following suit, but I think it was really pioneered really by the backup software guys first. And then the primary storage guys said, well, wait, that makes sense. And people want to use the cloud. And for certain workloads, it makes sense. And for other workloads, it does not. So I think it's just something that's started on the backup side and is now, you know, spreading into the primary storage side at the system level.
Mm-hmm. Any thoughts on that, Martin? I mean, you know, it's a complicated environment we're going to head towards if we're not careful.
Well, we are, and we're going to end up with different performance profiles as well. So as we're replicating data to and from the cloud, it's that consistency of performance, which is going to be challenging for some. It's certainly, people see cloud as a DR option quite a lot, but a lot of people are trying to replicate data into the cloud, whether it's VMware running on AWS or other ways of doing it. But when it comes up, what's it going to look like? What's performance going to be like? Is it still going to be the same? So yet again, it comes back to some of your storage guys who are quite used to dealing with this idea. They understand different tiers of performance. So we're going to say, but you're right, it's a complexity. Well, I do think any on-premises vendor which does not support the ability to replicate to cloud and bring up data services in the cloud is probably going to struggle over the next 5 years. It's going to be an absolute key capability for just about everybody.
HPE we've not mentioned, but HPE bought Zerto, and that's disaster recovery. HPE's GreenLake, Zerto's in the cloud.
Was that recovering the disaster of Zerto? Or was...
You just went off somebody's Christmas card list there.
I probably wasn't on it in the first place, but there you go, never mind. Sorry, Chris, I diverted you from your company.
I've quite forgotten. I'm wondering whether HPE will make GreenLake some kind of abstraction layer across all the clouds.
I don't even know what GreenLake is. I see it's from my perspective, it's a purchasing model that allows me to buy, theoretically, on some sort of on-demand model, service-based. But in reality, every time I've looked at it, it just seems to be an extension of a leasing model. It doesn't. I'm really not able to get my head around what it really is.
You're going to have somebody on the phone.
On the
block. So,
call Calvin Zito. Call Calvin Zito.
That poor person has tried to contact me a number of times to talk about GreenLake, and I really do shrug and think, you know what, this looks like it looks like a leasing financing model. I'm not quite sure. There's a lot of technology in there. Maybe there's a bit of technology to make it look and make it consumable. But it feels like we've seen this before, Chris. You know, this capacity on demand type model where vendor turns up, puts a load of stuff on your floor. You don't use it. There's a big argument about how you take it out. And everybody gets confused and gets disillusioned with it and thinks, well, that's not very elastic because you've put something physical on my premises and you've sunk a load of costs, which I might not be able to use.
Exactly, and we can probably blame Eric for OpenScale. Is it open? Not OpenScale. What was it called?
That was OpenScale. Yeah, and it was
it OpenScale EMC, which scaled only in one direction. It should have been called Uniscale or something like that, because it never scaled downwards, did it? Let's face it. And I think that is a problem.
I think the whole idea of infrastructure as a service, not just storage as a service, is you got to do the scale up and scale down. And if you don't, as you pointed out, Chris, it's only going one direction. But if you can scale up and scale down. I mean, the key thing when you think of storage as a service from a vendor perspective is it can look like a leasing model, but it's not a leasing model. If the legal entitlement to that physical array that's on the floor is held with the vendor, then all they're doing is doing a monthly billing, but it's not like a lease payment, right? Because they're not leasing it. The customer doesn't have a lease obligation. The customer is paying for kind of like the way you pay for the electrical bill. The difference is, you know, you got the physical box sitting on the floor and how much to use it. And again, if you don't scale down, so if in quarter A, they use a lot of storage, you scale up. And then in quarter B, they don't use a lot. So it should scale down, kind of the way a power bill works, especially, you know, since I happen to be in Silicon Valley, it doesn't get too warm where I am and it doesn't get too cold. But in other parts of the world, it goes way up. Your heating bill goes way up in the wintertime, and should your gas and power bill should drop a lot in the summertime. So it goes up and goes down. And that is supposed to be the model of infrastructure as a service for networking, storage, and servers. And I don't think everybody's doing it, but the idea is to not make it look like a lease model. And that's exactly what Martin said. You don't want it to be like that. Otherwise customers think I might as well just lease it. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. So here's a comparison then. Maybe GreenLake and those sort of things, Chris, are like leasing a photocopier. You know, you're in your office, you need a photocopier, you lease it, you don't own it. Somebody comes and services it if it breaks. If you need two photocopiers, you get two. If you need to get back down to one, you get one. But really, it's just you've just avoided buying the photocopier because it's better to lease it than it, sorry, to to rent it on a monthly basis than it is to pay the cost of buying one yourself.
I think there could be a difference in approach in that if you buy an array, then you're worried about hardware components. You're interested to find out that it's got NVMe SSDs or it's got 7,200 nearline drives. If you take the array through a GreenLake arrangement, you're looking for service level agreements and you no longer fussed about the hardware. In theory, as long as it delivers the service you want, then you're fine. That's what you've signed up to. And as long as you can get billed by the amount you use the array rather than paying some kind of quasi rent for the hardware sitting on your floor, then Bob's your uncle. You've got a cloud-like operating model.
Shall I tell you why that doesn't work?
Tell me.
There's a really good reason why that doesn't work. And the first reason is, if you look at the public cloud guys own everything. So they've already integrated the networking with the storage, with the compute. It all integrates. It's all API-driven. It's all seamlessly integrated to make one whole cloud product. If you lease your technology from, or you buy storage as a service from Dell, you've still got to think about compatibility. You've still got to plug it into a fabric. You've got to, still got to provision it. You're still going to hit issues with the way that you use that technology. There's still going to be compatibility questions that are going to come up. You're still going to have all of the technical aspects of integrating it into your environment that you had previously. All you've gained is offsetting some of the responsibilities around support and maintenance of that product. You haven't really gained anything else.
Let me dangle a big meaty worm in front of your gaping, hungry mouth.
Go on then.
Go all in. Get your servers and your networking and your storage and your software applications from GreenLake or via Apex from Dell EMC. Then all that integration worry goes away. It's been done for you.
Yeah, but that was the problem with CI, with converged infrastructure. You had to take the rubbish bits in order to get the integrated package when previously you had a choice to take best of breed.
There are no rubbish bits. What are you talking about? It's service level agreements.
I'm going to step away from the microphone.
If you're going to go all in with Apex or GreenLake, I don't see why you're just not buying public cloud. Apart from you might think, oh, well, I've got some data sovereignty issues or something like that. I just don't see they're attractive. If you're really interested in that sort of model, you probably ought to be looking at public cloud.
And you can even take things at outposts. So if you really physically need stuff on your own data center, then just use that. It's a really tricky one, Chris. I sort of see it, but I sort of see lots of reasons why I think I don't see it in the long term being as flexible, as practical, as useful as a private cloud on premises would be. So I'm still not convinced. You know, we'll just have to wait and see on that one. Having said that, perhaps we should talk about predictions in the future and where we see things going. And I'm going to ask you one, Chris, if I may. And this is related to our discussion last week. Do you see this analytics bubble bursting?
Not yet. I've thought about this for a little while. I think it'll carry on throughout 2022 because there's so much momentum behind it. Maybe if companies find out that all their analytics hardware and software isn't actually delivering the goods they want, that it's been oversold, then it'll start falling away in 2023, 2024. But this is just my abdomen thinking. I don't really have solid intelligence about it.
Any thoughts, Eric?
Well, right now I'd say, obviously the VCs have poured gobs in and have created, you know, data analytics unicorns, just like the way Uber and Lyft were years ago in the whole transport. So the real thing is, does that bubble burst? And I think, you know, Chris is correct. If people buy this and find out that all they need to do is do some traditional analytics without all these special things from the startups, then it bursts. If you have good customer experience and good results, like it really delivers something that the other ones didn't, then the VCs will pour more money in. You'll see more startups going, and you also will see some of the bigger companies buy some of the more successive data analytics companies and it'll get sucked up into the big companies, which kind of is the model in IT, right? You do something that gets successful, Microsoft buys it, Oracle buys it, IBM, EMC, everyone starts buying stuff up and sucking it in, or you create a new segment. I mean, cloud is the perfect example, right? Amazon was literally selling stuff on the internet, shoes and dishwashers and all that other stuff. And then, you know, AWS came along and they were able to keep it independent away from the big traditional IT vendors. Data analytics, I think, is either probably not going to go there. I think it's going to get sucked up into the big vendors if it's successful. So the VCs will pour more money, Chris Evans starts a company, Chris Miller starts a company, I do, Martin does, we all get big money and we deliver real value, then it could become its own sector. If Martin and Chris Miller only are successful and Chris Evans and I are not, then what will happen is the VC funding will dry up and all the big guys will buy Martin and Chris and people will get out there. But I think the number one issue to the bursting is it delivering real value to the end user versus the old way of doing analytics? And I think that that will determine the burst or the expansion and make the bubble even bigger. And Martin, you know, you're tied to the end user. So is anybody saying, hey, this is really working when they buy from these vendors, these new data analytics packages? Or are they saying, no, it doesn't really, I could have done it on my own, or I could have done it with the old stuff. Is it working?
I think there's a lot of emperor's new clothes going on at the moment. I think there's a lot of people who are maybe investing a lot of money in data analytics and may not really seeing it reflected on their bottom line. But they're going to not say, oh, we've just wasted, or we've just stood up a whole data analytics division. Because you know what CIO or CTO or CFO is going to stand up and say, yeah, that wasn't a great idea. I do think there's certain things where actually you look at the answers which they're coming out with, and you think, well, somebody with a bit of an experience could have just said, no, that will happen. I've looked at those figures. That's obvious. But I also wonder, it's because everybody else has got it, so we must have it. There is a fear, and it becomes an arms race. At the moment, yeah, I think it's going to keep growing. I think it will grow for the next 2 years. I think eventually somebody's probably going to do some proper ROI work and actually work out how, if I'm pouring all this money in, am I actually seeing anything on my bottom line? Am I seeing improved customer retention? Am I seeing my supply chain running more efficiently? Where is it? I think the jury's still out on a lot of this.
I'd use Eric's example as a bit of a, I don't know, an analogy for where we are. And that's, Eric, you mentioned Lyft and Uber and things like that. When these companies first started, they were seen as like the future of transport. Well, actually, really, they're just taxi companies. And they've turned out to be just taxi and delivery companies. Yes, they might have some clever tech that allows you to get billed on your iPhone and just step out of the cab or whatever. But ultimately, they don't do anything different than get you from A to B. It's the same thing. Now, are the data analytics companies giving you something that is magical over and above just a little bit of analysis of your data? I don't know. Maybe that's the question we should be asking.
Well, and that's why I said that's how the bubble will burst or not burst. If the end user really see it as different, then the bubble will keep going. If the end users see, as Martin said, it's really the emperor's new clothes and it's still the same emperor, then the bubble bursts, the VC funding goes away, no one buys them, or they buy the startup for tiny money, right? And I think that's why the true end user value is there. I would agree with you. Lyft and Uber were just putting technology. I mean, it's the same thing with Expedia and Travelocity, basically driving. I mean, I'm old enough to remember when my mother, when we would go on vacation, would go to the local travel agency, right? Go in, sit down with the woman or the guy, and we want to go to Disneyland. We need this, that, and the other thing. And then they book it, and that just, the technology just basically drove them out. So the real issue is data analytics going to drive out the old way of looking at the data or not? And it all depends on what Martin said. If it really makes a difference when they sit there with a spreadsheet and figure it out, they'll buy more. But if they don't, they'll say, what a waste of technology, stop buying, right? They'll know right away. And right now, I think people aren't sure whether it's a waste of money or a good investment. I think it's, yeah, people haven't really tracked, am I getting the real ROI, right? If I spend the money, is it worth it?
Yeah. All right. So I think we're almost out of time, guys. So I think it's an opportunity now to look forward and to try and think of what we think we might see as being interesting in the next 12 months, what we think we might see disappear in the next 12 months. What should we be watching out for? I'm going to hit Eric first on that one.
I think the number one thing is, does storage deliver value to applications and workloads? Everyone knows about, you got to put your data somewhere, but if you can do a consolidation play, or you can run 50 applications on the same storage instead of 50 different storage arrays, then that storage technology really is important to the applications and the workloads and saves you money. And if storage vendors can't translate that into real action to businesses, they're going to just view storage as a commodity, which some people do. But I do think there's an opportunity for the storage community to really like optimize workloads and applications at the business level, not just about my storage is better because it's fast. Okay, great. What does faster mean? To me, it's if they're running a workload with, and they put a stopwatch on it. And if on storage company A, it takes an hour with a stopwatch, and storage company B, it takes 10 minutes, then they've actually added real value to the applications and the workloads. And I think that's a trend storage guys, or the storage guys like us, will be eclipsed by the cloud guys, because it won't matter, right? Because we're not delivering real world applications and use cases better than the cloud guys will. That's where I think storage guys need to focus on for the next 2 years. Otherwise, the cloud guys will win, because cloud will end up being ubiquitous and more cost effective. And people just live with apps that are only so fast, because the storage vendors didn't really make them fast. So the storage guys wouldn't have done their job.
Okay. All right, Chris.
I think PCIe Generation 4, Generation 5, and CXL could be revolutionary technologies. I think the net effect of those three things could get data into servers faster than we can even imagine. They promise to be blindingly fast. Gen Z has gone away. It's been merged into CXL, which I think was a really, really smart move. And PCIe 5 SSDs are even starting to appear even now, leapfrogging PCIe even 4. I think these things are going to be absolutely fantastic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Martin.
Okay. So I think storage performance is going to become more and more of an issue. I think so. Always everything which you've Chris and Eric have just spoken about, and I think what's just going to drive it is a change in user behaviours. So I think what we're going to see is we're going to see the growth of no code and low code as a development technique. Now, we do know this is, it's almost back to a 4GL type environment, and we know those never perform particularly well. So I think the pressure on the performance on the storage hardware, whether it's in back-end in the cloud, whether it's things like Nitro and whatever Amazon doing their hyperscaler environments, or what's been done on-premises. So I think all we often sort of laugh about performance and it's just more speeds and feeds. I think this is actually going to become really, really important, because I think some of the optimizations which we've expected developers to do, and even good developers aren't very good at optimizing infrastructure now. We are now going to be in a situation where you're going to have business analysts and end users coding over the next 2 to 3 years. So the performance of your data fabric or your data tier is going to be really important.
Yeah, that's a really interesting one, I think, to see where we're going to head on that. Now, from my perspective, I think we'll see a short-term impact from Web3. As people try to do more of the decentralized storage sitting on, you know, on lots of little devices around the world, and now you can just book yourself a few terabytes that could be dispersed anywhere in a decentralized model. I wonder whether we'll see some of that actually work more practically, where we actually span different clouds. Something I looked at, I talked about like 15 years ago, redundant array of inexpensive clouds from a storage perspective. Maybe that's where that technology will head, because at the moment it seems to be all about hard drives sitting around in machines that are shared, and there's an opportunity for that to be done much more effectively across clouds, especially bearing in mind we have so many different clouds that are coming along with cheaper solutions to offer, you know, all the different wasabis and various other things like that. I think you're right about the technology being very interesting, Chris. I think the sort of direction that's going to head is interesting. And I think what Eric said about the application side of things, I'd just take that a step further and say, I do think that application data management, ownership, tracking your resources across your environment is going to become super critical. And we need to see some real good, solid plays in that area.
Four wise men. Yes, yes, we've got it. We've nailed it.
Well, you know, who knows? We could come here next year and be completely wrong, or we could just be as generic as possible this time round, and then nobody's ever going to know the difference. So, you know.
I was going to say, I have another prediction.
Go on then.
Tape doesn't die.
Oh, that's in the ransomware will get more pervasive comment,
yeah.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
Actually, we should have had a load of anti-predictions like that, shouldn't we? Yeah. Tape will never die. The mainframe won't go away. I don't know.
Hard disks will still be a thing.
Yeah, all that sort of stuff. All of those things that we know that are truisms of the industry that have been truisms forever. Yeah. But yeah, I don't know. I think there's still a future in storage. It's just like every part of IT, it just evolves and becomes something slightly different.
I would say that's absolutely true. And those who fail to adapt will be out of business.
Yeah. Let's hope we're still in business this time next year. but on that note, Thank you, everybody, for taking part today. It's been great to actually do something a bit different and get Eric involved. That's been really good. Congratulations, Eric, on pumping the company, I think, 3 or 4, maybe 5 times there. You did a really good job of getting in a good marketing message. Sapna will be so proud of you when you speak to her later. But, you know, other than that, for now, I really appreciate it. Thanks very much. And I'm sure we'll catch up in the future, yeah. in the next 6 months. But, yeah, for now, thanks, guys, and talk to you soon.
Pleasure. Great. Thanks, guys. Pleasure. Bye.
You've been listening to Storage Unpacked. For show notes and more, subscribe at storageunpacked.com. Follow us on Twitter at Storage Unpacked or join our LinkedIn group by searching for Storage Unpacked Podcast. You can find us on all good podcatchers, including Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. Thanks for listening.